does the bigger stuff, and we only have, you know, like.
Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Tuesday, March 23rd. Before we start our work, please call the roll.
Representative Levy.
Levy, here by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is here by video.
Representative Smith Warner is excused. Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. Thank you. We have three items on our agenda today. Public hearings on three bills. Is Representative Nose in the room with us at this time? I don't see him right now.
I don't believe so, Matt.
Okay. Will everybody who is not a member of the committee please turn off your camera and your microphone? And then we will be happy to see you and hear from you when you are called to testify. Cameras off and mics off, please. Do we have Representative Leaf with us in the room?
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
Then I am going to open the public hearings in a different order than they are published on the agenda so that we can accommodate the legislator who is with us right now. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2737. We have there's someone in the room with us who's not signed up on the witness list for this bill. We have eight people signed up to testify on House Bill 2737. We should have ample time to hear from everybody on all three bills today. If the testimony is limited to about 3 minutes a person, so I would really appreciate it if you could limit your testimony in that way. After Representative Leaf provides opening testimony, we will hear from Karen Hummelbaugh, Shenica Cumberbatch, and Michael Fieldman in that order, and then there's some after that. Representative Leaf, please go ahead.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Leaf. I am state representative for House District 2, and it's an honor to speak before this committee. Thank you for the time to talk about House Bill 2737, a bill that I've introduced to help remove an unfair tax burden for the AmeriCorps members when they go to use their education award that they earn after their year of service. For several years, I served on the board of directors of a Roseburg nonprofit that administers a local AmeriCorps program, so I'm very familiar with the great work these members have done in our local community. They have done everything from helping to get food to people through our food banks and starting community gardens to working with kids at our local Boys and Girls Club and at Phoenix School, our local alternative high school for higher risk students, to helping improve our local environment and work with our park systems, and most recently helping with COVID crisis response, as well as many other activities. These AmeriCorps programs are replicated throughout the state with over 750 AmeriCorps members serving each year. This is part of the more than 3,800 community members serving in all branches of the National Service in Oregon each year. The AmeriCorps portion of this is funded through a $12.8 million federal grant to Oregon that is administered through the Oregon Commission on a Voluntary Action and Service of Oregon Volunteers. This is a governor-appointed state commission. To be an AmeriCorps member, you have to commit a year of service at a particular site doing a particular job. While performing this work, the member earns below minimum wage, living allowance, of about $8.20 an hour. This is often not enough to cover food or rent or other basic needs. But it's not unusual for members to also apply for various forms of public assistance to get by. Along with this living allowance, members also receive a valuable education award of about $6,400 to offset higher education costs. This award is earned after successfully completing their year of service. The award can be used to pay for school costs or to pay off loans. The payment does not go to the member, but is paid directly to a school or to a loan holder. In Oregon, when this award is used, it becomes taxable, which means that member has to come up with about $600 in cash to access that education award, as nothing is withheld from the living allowances to cover the cost. Given this extremely low living allowance that they earn, finding this money can be difficult, if not impossible, for many members. This becomes a significant barrier for many members in even using this award. In fact, it's estimated that up to half of the awards are not used in part or fully. The other reality is that this tax disproportionately harms members from low-income, underserved BIPOC families, as they are the most challenged in finding additional monies needed to use their award. Besides benefiting the members, this award also brings value to the Oregon's higher education institution and supports statewide goals related to the workforce development and college access. Up to $2.7 million in education awards have been earned by AmeriCorps members in 2020, with more than 20,000 Oregon residents having earned education awards totaling more than $64.1 million since 1994. However, much of this goes unused because of the tax barrier Oregon puts in its way. Like I said, it's estimated about half of the awards are not used. Removing this barrier will ultimately bring much more revenue in a state system than it will lose in tax revenue. It also can act as an incentive for AmeriCorps members from other states to come to Oregon to attend schools knowingly that they won't have to pay taxes on it here, thus bringing still greater revenue to Oregon schools. Overall, this bill is a win-win for our state in that it brings us more money into the state and it removes barriers for low-income and historically disadvantaged people who are trying to improve themselves and enhance their education. It's also the right thing for members to commit a year of their lives to make Oregon a better place. Because of this, I humbly ask you to approve House Bill 2737 and vote it out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Leaf, for bringing this bill to us. Legislative Revenue Office, do you have anything to add to present the bill to us before I call the witnesses on the witness list?
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, just a quick word on House Bill 2737. How it works is it's creating a personal income tax subtraction for the amounts received from the AmeriCorps Education Award. So this would be a subtraction here in Oregon where that education award received would then not be subject to Oregon taxation. It still would be subject to federal taxation, however. And it would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2021.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question is just to clarify with Mr. Easton in LRO, is this is an income tax. So when I hear people are being taxed, this is being treated as income and then taxed accordingly. Is that correct? It's not a transactional tax.
That's correct, Representative Reschke. Yes, it's related to the income tax.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for LRO? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this forward. It seems like a reasonable request. Do we know what the impact is on the general fund? How much money will need to be subtracted out through folks who are utilizing this opportunity?
Yes, Representative Smith, that's not something I've worked up to date yet. We would be working on the revenue impact statement following this initial public hearing to get some sense of how much these awards, as was just discussed by Representative Leaf, the award amount and the potential of that being, I suppose, used, and then some of the unused amount that could then be used going forward, I suppose, as well. But that's something we can definitely look into and share with the committee members as we acquire that information.
Perfect. And I guess my last question is, at some point, can one of the folks who will be testifying in support share with me the number of AmeriCorps National Service Education Awards are in the state of Oregon? And so, again, thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this forward, and thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to ask those two questions.
That's great, and we'll look forward to some more answers in the following testimony. My interest is in comparing this, where we are, where these people are benefiting from some help for education, how that compares to how the state or federal government taxes or doesn't tax when grants and scholarships are paid to other educational institutions.
Well, yeah, so Madam Chair, to that question, there is an exclusion right now existing at the federal level and the state level related to scholarship income. So long with certain restraints on how the income is used for tuition and fees and such. So that is exempt. That's been exempt, I think, going back to the 50s. In part, at that time, it was viewed, these scholarships were viewed in a way as a gift. And as gifts are generally not subject to taxation, they fit within that. I guess the policy rationale has maybe changed a little bit over the years as that has developed, over also providing assistance to individuals that are attending higher education and using these scholarship amounts. A thing to note is a company scholarship program, by contrast, will often be taxable depending upon the design of that scholarship program. So if a company sets up a scholarship program for employees or their employees' children, that fits more into a compensation amount, or which generally falls into subject to taxation. So a lot of times if you're trying to bifurcate this, if it's falling under more of a gift, that's usually going to be exempt. Whereas if it's more of a form of compensation, then that's where you fall into the taxable realm, as it's more aligned to income. But that's kind of the setup there for some of that policy discussion.
Thank you for that. Representative Smith.
Oh, I need to take my hand up, but I would share, Madam Chair, I think your question was right on the mark.
Thank you. Anything else for LRO before we go to the rest of the witness list? Okay, Karen Hummelbaugh, followed by Shenika Cumberbatch.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Karen Hummelbaugh. I'm the Director of the Office of Workforce Investments at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And I'm here to assure that you understand the structure of the AmeriCorps program in Oregon, as well as the importance of the Education Award for its members. While our agency can't take a position on House Bill 2737, we want you to be informed about the importance of the program and its benefits to our state. AmeriCorps programs are part of a larger national service portfolio that was established federally in 1993. And programs in that portfolio include the AmeriCorps state programs, as well as other nationally run programs you may have heard of, like Volunteers in Service to America, or VISTA, and the National Civilian Community Corps, otherwise as known as NCCC. In Oregon, these state AmeriCorps programs fall under the Higher Education Coordinating Commission's Office of Workforce Investments umbrella, and we have a 25-member governor-appointed commission called Oregon Volunteers that implements these service opportunities meant to strengthen all of our communities. We fund 9 AmeriCorps state programs that serve a majority of our counties across the state, and in an average year, we have about 750 individuals serving in one of these state or national service programs in Oregon. The types of service opportunities members participate in fall into categories that generally are education, economic opportunity, disaster response, environmental stewardship, veteran services, and healthy futures. And these volunteer opportunities are critical to our communities, but they're also critical to the individual members serving in those communities. Members often come from and serve in marginalized and underserved places across the state. Because these programs are volunteer, service members only receive what we would consider a small living allowance or stipend during their service, and that's why the Siegel Education Award received upon completion of their service is an important benefit. In 2020, there were 754 AmeriCorps members who completed their term of service, so as part of that completion of their volunteer time, they do earn that education award. And it's important to note that the funds go directly to the accredited post-secondary education or training institution that the member enrolls in, not directly to the individual. So members completing a year of service this year will receive an education award of $6,345. And the award currently has the tax liability associated with it, making that burdensome for some members, because obviously they can't use that money to pay for it because it's going directly to the institution. So members trying to come up with the liability out of pocket are trying to do so after serving a volunteer year with no income. And I know there are a number of written submissions. There are some members who'd like to speak to you all, so I don't want to take more time, but I do want to close by emphasizing the importance of the national service opportunities we have in this state. We saw this especially in 2020 with a pandemic, wildfires, changes in our educational delivery, and a need for our economic recovery. And our members were able to be there more than ever in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Hummelbaugh, just a real quick question as far as, are you aware of how other income tax states treat this gift, or I guess a grant, the education award? Are you aware of how, say, California does it or some other income tax states do it? You may not know the answer to that, and if not, then I'll ask LRO to maybe get us some information on that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, I do not know the answer to that off the top of my head. I do know that different states treat this differently. So it probably is a good one for the fiscal folks to tackle.
Thank you for your presentation. And this is a reminder to people that we're asking you to limit your remarks to 3 minutes each so that we can have all the witnesses for this bill and the other two bills that we're hearing today. I hope we can get through all of them. Next is Shenica, followed by Mike Bildman, Amory Lovell, and Carmen Dennison. So, Shenica, you're next.
Hello, it's Shenica, actually.
Thank you.
Thank you, though. Hello, everyone. Thank you, first of all, for Representative Nathanson and Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke for allowing me to speak today. My name is Shenica Cumberbatch. I'm representing Oregon Volunteers Commission board member and also AmeriCorps alumni. I served with the AmeriCorps VISTA program from 2017 to 2019. I moved from Florida to Central Oregon for my VISTA service. During my first year of service, I had a hard time making ends meet as our pay at that time for VISTAs was about $463 every 2 weeks. I had rent of $525, which included my utilities, plus a car note, car insurance, cell phone, etc. I worked a second job at the local Best Buy in town to help supplement the missing funds, as it was the only way I was going to survive each month. It wasn't easy, but I wanted to continue to serve the community I was in. At the end of my first year of service, I received my education award, the Siegel Award. At that time, the award was about $5,895. As I wanted to start grad school, I knew this was a way for me to pay for school. I made a payment towards my interest of student loans that had accrued during my first year of service, and then I used the following amount to pay, for the rest of grad school. Once I used my Ed Award, I did not know that I would have to pay the taxes on it, as it is counted as income. How can an education award be taxed when you give a year of service to your community? Since then, I've been making payments on back taxes that I owe to the state of Oregon. For the 2018 tax year, I owed $860. I have completed that portion, and I'm still making payments on the 2019 tax year. My payments are now $157. At first, they used to be $263. For some time there, I fell behind on my payments and interest accrued. I went from $860 in back taxes to $1,200. And when you're AmeriCorps Vista leader, that was my second year of service, it was even more of a struggle to pay that plus my bills. This is a great opportunity for many, many people to serve with the AmeriCorps. It's just when we finish our service, we are sentenced with this burden that we have to face for the next couple years until it is done. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Shanika, with apologies. Mike, you're next.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Pham and Reske, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk about House Bill 2737. For the record, my name is Michael Fieldman. I live in Roseburg, which is in Douglas County, and I'm currently the legislative assistant for Representative Leaf. I've also been an eight-year member of the Oregon Volunteers Commission and have been its past chair. Additionally, prior to my position with Rep Leaf, I had a 45-year career in running a variety of human service programs, including administering AmeriCorps programs for 25 years. Needless to say, I've seen the very positive impact AmeriCorps service has had on both the communities receiving its service and on the individuals who serve as AmeriCorps members. As you've heard, this bill allows AmeriCorps members to use their education award without having to come up with the money to pay the state taxes that are assessed at its use. AmeriCorps members earn the award of about $6,400 after their year of service. They earn this in addition to their below minimum wage living allowance of about $8.20 per hour. The payment of the taxes only occurs if the award is used, so no taxes are withheld from their living allowance, which means people have to come up with extra cash if they want to use the award. Also, the award payment goes directly to the school or a loan payment and not to the member. Given that the members' wages are barely covered, can barely cover the basic costs of life, coming up with this extra money can be very problematic. This bill will remove a barrier to using this hard-earned benefit. There are actually three reasons why this is a good idea. The first is that it makes good financial sense to the state. If a member cannot use their education award, then the state does not get any tax revenue anyways, but it loses the $6,400 that would have been spent on the school costs, including tuition. And it does not take too many members not using their award to outweigh the lost tax revenue. This year alone, there are about 750 members serving in Oregon. You know, there's an old saying about being a penny wise, but a pound foolish. I think this saying applies to this tax. The state would be better getting the $6,400 in tuition. The second reason this bill is a good idea is because it addresses an equity problem this tax creates, in that the people who struggle most to find the additional money for the taxes will most likely come from lower income and disadvantaged families, as they can't go to family members for financial help, something members from higher income families could do. This tax, therefore, has a disproportionately negative impact on families from lower income and BIPOC households. We need to be looking for ways to remove barriers to education for this population, not imposing them. Finally, this bill is a good idea because it's the right thing to do. AmeriCorps members commit a year of their lives to benefit our communities, and they do it at near or below poverty level wages. To then ask them to pay extra to use a benefit they have worked hard to earn is not a great way of saying thank you for the year of service they have given our communities. Removing this minimal tax revenue to the state, a significant tax burden to the members, would be the right way of expressing appreciation for the sacrifices they make for Oregon's betterment. Because of this, I ask you to support the passages of this bill out of committee.
Thank you for the testimony. Next is Amory Lovell, followed by Carmen Dennison, then Isabel Barcelona.
Hi there, this is Amory. Can you all hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Great. My camera doesn't work. My computer's just old enough that you won't be able to see my beautiful face. I am a program director at Ethos Music Center, and we have AmeriCorps members placed out in rural Oregon communities where they serve as music facilitators as those small towns build up the funds and the support to hire on a teacher full time. A lot of the people who have spoken previous to me have brought up all the numbers and digits, how this will financially affect Oregon, but I would like to talk about how it humanly affects Oregon. A number of our former AmeriCorps members have gone on to be hired in these communities to be the full-time music teacher or the part-time music teacher, not only contributing economically to these disadvantaged rural towns, but also the human and cultural contributions that they do. I love the thought of taking away this taxation on the education award and attracting even more wonderful young AmeriCorps members into teaching positions or service positions throughout the state. I think Shanika is a prime example of how lucky Oregon was to attract her as an AmeriCorps member, and in addition to her service. I would just like to see AmeriCorps members like her receive just a little bit extra benefit. They truly do work hard. They truly do work at a bare minimum, and I feel we deserve to give them just a little bit of heart and do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Smith, did you have a question? Maybe not. Okay. Thank you. Carmen Dennison.
Thank you, Rep. Nathanson. This is Greg. No, I didn't have a question. I'm sorry.
Thanks for clarifying. We'll hear from Carmen, followed by Isabella Barcelona and Bennett Minton. I see that there is someone who's joined us with the phone number for Carmen Dennison. We can't hear you. Have you pressed star 6 to unmute yourself?
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Please, please go ahead.
Wonderful. Great. Hi, everyone. My name is Carmen Dennison, and I am the executive director at Campus Compact of Oregon. I am also a former AmeriCorps member and an AmeriCorps program manager. So Campus Compact of Oregon has hosted hundreds of AmeriCorps members during its 10-year partnership with the Corporation for National and Community Service. Our organization is known for its racial justice and equity mission, and we're also known for hosting the most diverse cohort, AmeriCorps cohort in Oregon. Our agency hosts between 35 and 72 AmeriCorps members annually. And then, as mentioned, our AmeriCorps members are mostly Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and range in age, gender identity, and sexual orientation. So our cohorts are also deeply intersectional. Contrary to popular assumptions about national service members as not knowing what it is like to live under the poverty line, our members make great financial sacrifices to provide culturally specific services to their own communities. Many of them understand personally the tangible impacts of systemic racism and poverty. For these members, the decision to serve is not made out of a choice to understand the plight of those deemed unfortunate, but rather to commit to uplifting, empowering, and caring for their own communities. For those that don't know, AmeriCorps serves as a springboard for careers in the nonprofit and government sectors. As AmeriCorps, an AmeriCorps term is a period of applied learning during which time future leaders in civic life are provided the education that only real life experience provides. Most AmeriCorps members have at least an associate's degree. Most didn't start school with a trust fund, and most already struggle to afford their education, a critical pathway to a sustained and fulfilling career and economic mobility. So this is why I'm here today, to advocate for House Bill 2737. Our state and moreover our country needs to provide more support to those who commit their lives to public service and alleviate the financial burden associated with the Siegel Education Award, which is oftentimes less than $7,000. It doesn't seem like that much money, but it really does. It's one of the few monetary benefits associated with a year of service. This resource, while small, is really, really significant and allows low-income and first-generation university and college students to pay off student loans or pursue and further their education after serving their communities as an AmeriCorps member. I believe that this should be one of many steps to reward those who work to improve our society as a whole and make tangible investments in the future of their communities. I think that also, you know, in appreciation for the great service that members provide, we should work toward providing, investing more in the financial futures of AmeriCorps members who really are going to, you know, be the leaders of tomorrow. Thank you.
Isabella, you're next. And thank you, Carmen. Isabella, are you with us?
Can the chair and the members of the committee hear me?
Yes, please proceed.
Hi, thank you. My name is Isabella Barcelona from Lane County, and I am an AmeriCorps alum who served with the Portland Confluence Center in Portland from 2015 to 2017. I truly believe that my time in AmeriCorps gave me invaluable experiences and networking connections within the local environmental community. I felt that I gave a much needed service to the local environment and especially to the low income communities that I served with. As many of my AmeriCorps counterparts and some who have mentioned today, I had a second job while serving to be able to afford my monthly expenses. I worked at night and on the weekends managing a local bar. While it meant I didn't get to take advantage of many of the networking opportunities that my counterparts did, it meant that I was able to continue serving in AmeriCorps in a position that I very much enjoyed and felt was very needed. You know, as is the reality with many in my generation, my student loans were at a level that I do not expect to pay off in the near or frankly far future. I ended up using my education award to pay off the student loan with the largest interest rate, and which was able to give me manageable monthly payments that I was able to work with.
Excuse me, there's someone whose mic is not muted and it's interfering with the person who's testifying. Well, everybody, thank you. Please go ahead. I'm sorry about the interruption. Isabella, go ahead. Isabella, are you still with us?
I think I was accidentally muted. Can you hear me now?
Yes, please proceed. We're trying to move quickly through this bill. I'm sorry about the interruption.
No worries. Essentially, without my education award, I would not have been able to make my monthly payments for my student loans, which is, frankly, a reality for many in my position. I truly believe that eliminating the tax on the AmeriCorps Education Award for our state will ensure that many more people can devote their time and effort to serving these communities. I really encourage it to be considered as a reality. I think that's about all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony and your patience with us as we worked on that audio issue. The last speaker is Bennett Minton. Star 6 to unmute, and let's move quickly if you're still with us.
Sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
I can.
Great. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bennett Minton, submitting testimony on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon, a network of volunteers advocating a rational and equitable tax code. AmeriCorps has no greater fan than I. I was on the staff of the House committee that wrote the AmeriCorps legislation in 1993. The only time my boss ever said what I wrote for him was when the White House gave him 2 minutes to speak at the signing ceremony, and the president's schedule confined him to my text. More broadly, no career achievement resonates for me like meeting someone who tells me of his or her AmeriCorps service, and many do. It's a great program. If the decision were mine, national service would be mandatory. So would better compensation. And I question this bill. Its underlying purpose is having other Oregon taxpayers say thank you to AmeriCorps participants by treating their income differently than other income. That is contradictory to principles outlined in ORS 316.003, in which the legislature pledges a tax system with fairness and equity as its basic values. By its plain language, the bill would create a difference state tax treatment than provided for federal treatment under which these awards are subject to tax. How it would affect AmeriCorps participants would depend on their particulars. I haven't seen any data on how many Oregon taxpayers are affected or how much they owe at various levels. Perhaps the committee might delve into that. Some other questions for your consideration. Would the treatment accorded under the bill change behavior? Would it generate interest or participation in AmeriCorps? How would a young Oregonian considering national service learn of this tax break? Would it be the tipping point in applying, and how would we know? The purpose of the tax code is to raise revenue to fund whatever services you, as our representatives, judge appropriate. Exceptions to the equitable taxation of income should be well understood and justified. This one appears to arise from a fine notion: community service should pay better. But does that point toward disparate taxation of income? We think not. I suggest two ways the legislature could otherwise subsidize AmeriCorps service. The first is within the committee's purview, and that is to raise tax bracket thresholds and make the income tax more progressive so that those with similar low incomes are treated similarly. Or the legislature could create a state stipend, perhaps administered through the Higher Education Coordinating Commission or other appropriate body, providing for the program to be judged and revised each biennium. Of course, it may be easier to pass this bill and move on to other things, but it would punch another hole in the tax code. And as the accustomed and often unpopular scold on the integrity of our tax system, I urge you to lay the bill on the table. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please turn your audio off. There's feedback. Thank you. Committee, are there any questions for the witnesses before I close the public hearing on this bill? I don't see any. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2737. We have a legislator with us in the room. I am opening now House Bill 2737. 2972, public hearing on House Bill 2972, LRO. Would you please present the bill for us?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2972 would require the Legislative Revenue Office to study land value taxation and submit a report to an interim revenue committee. The bill defines land value taxation, basically having land taxed at a higher rate than improvements. And the bill lays out information that is to be included in the study.
Thank you. Representative Nose, you're first.
All right, thank you. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm back. For the record, my name is Rob Nose, and I'm the state representative for Inner Southeast Portland and a little sliver of Northeast Portland. And I'm here to give some brief remarks in support of House Bill 2972, which, as Director Alanak explained, would require the Legislative Revenue Office to study land value taxation and submit a report of the findings to the legislature no later than September of 2022. Now, colleagues, before I dive into why this bill is important, I think it's important to provide some background on land value taxation, since it's not a widely known concept here in the United States. Bear with me while I lay out some of the groundwork. Land value taxation taxes the highest use value of land in contrast to conventional property tax structures, which include the value of buildings or improvements when assessing value. It's intended to counter the monopolization of land, incentivization landowners to use their land more productively. Now, our current property tax system taxes land and improvement values at the same rate. The tax falls lightly on land-consuming use where building investments are minimal. A split-rate tax would encourage development as owners realize the tax benefits of building more intensively on underutilized, centrally located sites. A lower tax rate on improvements would encourage owners of rental property to repair neglected buildings. Cities, I would argue, have had little success in using code enforcement to compel property owners to make needed repairs, because they know that if they comply, their property tax bills will increase. With a lower tax rate on building upgrades to deteriorating structures, they wouldn't be penalized with higher tax bills, and lower tax rates on improvement assessments would encourage owners to make repairs or replace buildings and other needed updates. Additionally, this could help solve the housing affordability crisis over the long run without revenue losses from housing subsidies by reducing residential land price inflation, thus preventing real estate bubbles that led to the 2008 economic collapse. This has been proven to work in other states such as Pennsylvania, where cities in Pennsylvania have adopted land value taxation models. It's been shown that the land tax boosts construction activity even in communities with lagging economies. The incentive effect of lowering tax rates on building assessments could have effects similar to rural enterprise zones. But unlike granting exemptions under the current property tax regime that we're currently operating under, the land-based tax system would not result in a loss of local revenue. Now, the study requires by this bill would provide analysis of how land value taxation would work in our state, specifically on how do you apply differential property tax rates using land value taxation would help solve the disparities and woes that we are constantly analyzing with regard to Measure 5 and Measure 50. Modeling comparisons of tax applications using true market assessments and a revenue-neutral framework. Examining how this would impact selected local, urban, and rural areas. Examining comparative economic incentives effects on property in selected areas currently utilizing rural enterprise zones and tax incentives, and evaluating tax burden relief measures that might accompany land value taxation, including homestead exemption, property tax deferral for homeowners who are financially overburdened. This bill is not to suggest, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that we commit to using this model, but rather it is to provide more information for all of us to consider whether or not this is something our state should do. And, you know, I have to admit, Madam Chair, when I was first pitched this, it's a pretty different concept. And I would not want to go into this idea lightly. especially if it's something that we think we actually might work for our state. It would be a very big change in our system. But I think it's one that's worth evaluating, and that's why it's here before you today. And I believe there's a, you can't see them virtually, but behind me, if we were in a hearing room, there's a bunch of smart people who are prepared to talk about how they've looked into it and what they've seen. But candidly, they need smart people in the legislature also to make an evaluation of this idea and come back to us as well. It's not going to be enough to just have smart people from the community and universities and economists. We need our own smart people to examine this idea as well. And that's why I brought it forward. And I hope you'll think about supporting this, Madam Chair and members of the committee, because I think this is an idea worth investigating. And that thank is my you, testimony.
Thank you, Representative Nose. We do have three more people signed up to testify on this bill, and then six or seven more on the next bill.
Are there questions for me, or are they just hands?
I'm going to get to that in a minute.
Okay.
I wanted to let you know, because you referred to three other people, we will be hearing from Chris Nelson, Tom Gehring, and Steph Ruth. So, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nose, I really, really appreciate you bringing this concept forward. While I'm in no way certified smart, I can share with you, I'm very familiar with this concept and how it works. And it really is a great opportunity for neighborhoods to reinvest in themselves without significantly impacting property tax revenues. And so I'm really pleased you brought this forward, and I hope we'll give it strong consideration, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Great. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and likewise, Representative Nose, thanks for the bill. And I don't know if this is a question for you or LRO, but I'm just curious, does this just apply to urban growth boundaries or metropolitan areas, or does it also apply to farm and ag and timberland?
I believe it would apply to everything, but I would ask you to check in with the certified smart people that are coming up next.
All right, thank you.
Representative Levy.
Well, Representative Nose, thank you very much. And Representative Reschke asked my question because, as you know, I come from high-value land areas where it's high-value ag property, where we produce that goes through the state of Oregon and across the United States. And so I would think that this would not be a very good bill for high-value farm ground, but probably a wonderful bill for communities that are in the Portland area or Bend or wherever. So if it was limited, if it could be limited to that kind of stuff, you know, it would. I agree that it's probably a really good bill.
Madam Chair, if I may?
Briefly, sure.
My comment would be this, which is, I think the comments that were made by Rep. Levy are well-intended, and I think the point of a study is to exactly do what's kind of she's getting at, which is, does it have some impact on forestry or agricultural land that's unintended? And maybe it would be, as you pointed out, only something that would work in cities, or highly dense counties, and so we would have a different approach for what we might do with agricultural. I don't know, all right? But I think there's something to this, and that's why I want to have it studied so that we can explore all those kind of questions and see if we can get answers to them. Because you don't want to, we have a very complicated tax system that, in my opinion, needs a massive overhaul, and maybe this is the massive overhaul that would actually work.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just left my hand up, so move along.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for being with us, Representative Nose. Stick around if you'd like, but I'm.
Well, I'll probably just listen to this later this evening because I got to go back to my committee. So.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Next is Chris Nelson. We're asking for 3 minutes,
yes,
or less.
3 minutes. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. This is Chris Nelson. I am the legislative director for Common Ground Oregon Washington, and we are a chapter of a national organization that supports public values and capturing publicly created values in resources and common areas. Yes, I'd just like to touch on a couple of principles behind the rather successful use of land value taxation around the world. And the first important one is that our tax structure should encourage publicly desirable outcomes. That seems like, you know, a pretty obvious principle, but the point is to try and encourage capital investment with our tax structure, and to also then minimize the effects of the tax structure on publicly created values. And the other important principle here is to note how land value and improvement values are created. Land value is very different. It is actually created through a combination of, public investments, public actions such as zoning, certainly amenities, parks, sidewalks, streets, lights, sewers, and of course, location values. And we should know that improvement values are primarily created by the private sector through capital investments. So it would be ideal then if our property tax structure actually encouraged these kinds of outcomes. So another principle here for the use of land value taxation is that it would be revenue neutral. All places where it has been introduced, while it may phase in a higher rate on improvements and then a lower rate on land values, the other way around, a higher rate on land values and a lower rate on improvements, it would do so over many years, perhaps 5, even 10 years, and start as a revenue neutral effect. So the study does just that. It actually does assume revenue neutrality. Then the other point here is to note why Measure 5 limitations don't work well with land value taxation.
Yes. Chris, that was 3 minutes.
Okay.
I hope if you have additional information for us, you do have 24 hours to submit it in writing so that we can read anything else you might have wanted to let us know about.
Certainly. I would be happy to submit that as a PowerPoint presentation, Chair Nathanson. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Tom Gehring, followed by Steph Ruth. Tom?
Am I on now?
Yes, please begin.
All right, thank you. I just wanted to bring attention to a study that was completed in June of 2019. This was done by the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State. I'm sure you're familiar with this organization. They have done several studies for the state legislature. This one is a study of land value tax simulating the effects of LVT in Multnomah County. Can you see the report?
Yes, we see it. Thank you for the illustration.
I would encourage you very strongly to take a look at this report. You'll find it on the website of NERC, Northwest Economic Research Center. So the study that NERC completed confirmed the growing inequities that Measure 5 and 50 have caused over the past 25 years. And the reason for that is the widening gap between maximum assessed value, the taxable values, because of the 3% growth limit on assessments per year, and the real market values. The gap continues to widen. By now, for example, the Inner Northeast Portland, the taxable values comprise only 29% of the total real market values. And in the Outer Southeast, the reverse is happening. So you can see the inequities that would develop from that. I would just like to read you the conclusion from the study that NERC completed, that ultimately land-based property tax systems are found to achieve what they are designed to do, place more of a tax burden on wealthier landowners and encourage the highest and best use of land. Based on simulations performed on properties in Inner Northeast and Outer Southeast Portland communities, an LVT would provide a more equitable tax structure, incentivize building, upgrading, and development of underutilized properties, and discourage holding land for speculative purposes. In short, many of the inequities created by Measure 5 and 50 would likely be reversed if LVT were implemented in the Portland region. Otherwise, I can continue by answering questions. I know one has come up, and if you don't mind, if I can address that question that pertained to rural lands and resource lands.
I'm sorry, that's 3 minutes, but okay. I do invite you to write a response and send it to us. You have 24 hours from when this meeting started to submit that, and we'll look forward to reading it.
All right.
Thank you. Steph is next.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke, and members of the committee. Promise this is going to be under 3 minutes. Thank you for your hospitality today. My name is Steph Routh, and I am Strategic Communications Manager at Sightline Institute. Sightline is an independent think tank working to advance sustainability in the Pacific Northwest. I come to you today in fervent support of HB 2972, which would direct a study of land value taxation for Oregon. As my colleague, Michael Anderson shared with you in his written testimony, land value taxes are easily summarized thus. Instead of taxing useful investment, they tax land speculation. A land value tax would disincentivize central city landowners from holding land off the market in hopes of using scarcity to maximize their future payday. It would efficiently capture the value of public investments, and that value could be reinvested to create affordable housing and other amenities that help more Oregonians benefit. Land tax value taxation can't solve every problem, but it could help solve many. I'll just say also, as former executive director of Oregon Walks, personally, I can confidently say that transit access, walkable amenities, age friendliness, and social equity form a covalent bond of neighborhood vibrancy. Our current tax structure, one that too often rewards corporate squatting, does not exactly set us up for success. So questions, including Representative Levy's, which this is the glory of a study. I think that it recognizes that land value is contextual. And so we have that chance through a study to explore questions. Other questions, how can we move from incentivizing land speculation to land utilization? How can we ensure that the places surrounding our public infrastructure investments are activated for and welcoming to more communities? What could tax burden relief measures entail for homeowners who are financially overburdened? Answer to these questions and more can come from a study on LVT. So this concept deserves a full airing in Oregon. Please pass 2972, and thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. A question for you, Steph, or anyone on the panel, but since you were the most recent speaker, I am just wondering how these land value systems contemplate growth. That's one of the big challenges we have And we can see different resolutions to that through reassessment and purchase or the 3%. How does it work in a system like this?
Right. I went most recently. I would defer to Tom, if Tom, you're still around.
Oh, you'll need to unmute.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't exactly clear about that, the question about growth.
Well, how does the tax grow over time or adjust over time? Like we have in Oregon, we have a 3% growth in the assessed value that was set a long time ago. In California, there's a reset on purchase. How does it work under a scheme like this?
Okay. Well, what this would be is a local option for cities or counties to adopt a land value tax, which would exempt the jurisdictions from the Measure 5 and 50 limitations. In other words, we would go back to real market assessments. It's the only way you can really do any kind of a reasonable, fair tax, especially with a land value tax that has incentives attached to it. So yes, it would be RMV, real market values. And those market values would then be the basis for the tax rate. But the tax rate would be set by the revenue, which would be revenue neutral compared to what the system is now. And so the tax rate would be split between land and improvements, higher rate on land, lower rate on improvements. The total amount of revenue received would be the same as it would be with the land value tax not in place, or with a existing tax structure. Does that help answer?
Madam Chair, just a follow-up for Bert.
I do need to move on to the next bill, if it can be quick.
So just to verify, property is frequently reassessed and the tax is adjusted based on that reassessment.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. That's correct. It must be said that assessments have to really be accurate for this to work, and they have to be up to date. And they will be true market values, the basis for assessing any property. But the tax rate depends on the total revenue, which is approved. So the tax rate would certainly go down compared to the tax rate that we have now on MAVs, because the real market values are higher. So it's all revenue neutral.
Thank you for that response. That is very closely related to a topic that we've discussed in other meetings related to our assessments up to date and how do they vary in their status of being accurate or up to date. How do they vary from one county to another?
Yeah.
And we will have ample time to discuss that in a future meeting if we keep working on this bill or the other topic from other bills. Thank you all. Representative Marsh, was that extent of your question there?
That's fine. Thank you. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
And please do remember that you can submit written testimony within 24 hours of when this meeting started. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2972, and I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3317. LRO, do you have like a 1 minute introduction for this?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern from Legislative Revenue. I think it's less than 1 minute. House Bill 3317 would exempt hay bale machinery and equipment from property taxes by listing it out specifically by the form and function.
Thank you. Representative Marsh, did you have a question? Okay. Committee, we don't have time to hear all the testimony there. There are six people signed up to testify, and we don't have time to continue through all of them. Unless people are super fast, which I don't want to cause someone to be super fast. So my intent is to take one speaker for, one against, and one neutral, and anyone else, if there's time remaining. I do want to close the meeting by 10 till. So, we will hold over the public hearing to our next meeting date, which is Thursday. Is that right, Mr. Alanak? Thursday? Anyone who doesn't get to testify today will be able to testify at our very next meeting. But I'd like to start the testimony, and let's see how much we can get through. First is Eric Lerwick.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Good. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, thank you for taking the time. I'll try and be as fast as I can to get as many people through. My name is Eric Lerwick, and I'm the general manager of Farmers Direct. We are a pressing and export company in Yamhill County. And this whole pressing industry of straw started as a result of the burn ban more than 40 years ago that took place in Oregon. During a grass seed harvest, basically a combine comes through a field, and it will combine off the seed and throw the straw out the back. There's in a field, there could be a lot of straw. For example, in a heavy fescue field, there could be 3.5 to 4 tons of straw per acre that comes out of the back of the combine. And without the ability to burn that, we have to bale it off. and with nowhere to go with this straw anymore, industrious Oregonians developed a market overseas, and the only way to make that work cost effectively is to press it. And pressing is now a vital part of that grass seed harvest. The hay, straw, grass, and other plants that go into the press come out of the press basically the same. They're just 30 or 40% more dense. The press takes that baled material and smashes it small with hydraulics. Unlike a mill that takes logs and makes lumber, the end user or a press just takes a bale of straw or hay and makes it smaller. The reason we press the material is to make it more efficient for storage and transport. When we transport straw or hay for export, we put it in ocean freight containers to ship overseas, and we are charged per container for the ocean freight, and we sell per ton. So this means to make it work and to be competitive with other countries that we're, you know, like China or Australia that we're competing with in Korea and Japan, we have to get it there as efficiently as possible. I'm already done. Anyways, we're in full support of House Bill 3317 to reduce our costs and keep us competitive in the world market.
Thank you for your testimony. And there's a question, Representative Smith.
Not a question, a statement. Okay. Madam Chair, I'm really pleased that you let this gentleman share his perspective. I've always wondered what was the history and rationale of us selecting one industry and certain equipment for a tax exemption. But as you think through it, there's a logic to it and why that occurred. And so thank you for allowing that to be shared.
Oh, thank you for your comment, Representative Smith. The next speaker will be Mark Garst, followed by Jeff Stone.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the League of Oregon Cities. Consistent with our position on previous bills that kind of address the same issue, including House Bill 2429 and 2019, the League is concerned about this bill, and we are opposed. The bill, as we've heard, would exempt hay bale compression equipment. I'd encourage you to go on YouTube and take a look at what this equipment looks like. This is really large equipment in a, you know, big facility. It looks more or less like a factory. And, you know, when we talk about exempting farm equipment, generally we have a broad exemption for personal property, which is movable equipment, and then very narrow exemptions for machinery and equipment. And often the equipment that we have exempted under machinery and equipment, like this equipment, would be on the farm, where these facilities actually might serve multiple farmers who would bring their product in, have it compressed and then shipped out. So it's a little bit, it feels a little bit different to us. I'm not certain how many of these are located in cities, but certainly they could be. I'm not certain how many of these are owned by farmers, but I do know that, you know, they often are compressing for other folks. So it's kind of its own line of business as opposed to what we might think of strictly as farming. We do know that there's a tax court case right now working its way through the tax court, and this effort would certainly end run that process. Specific concerns that we have with the bill as written, one, it's a mandate. It doesn't allow a local option for whether or not a local jurisdiction might want to exempt this equipment. And two, unlike a lot of our economic development incentives, this is a permanent exemption. This is not like a five-year exemption that you might see on an enterprise zone, for instance. I hate to be a broken record, but our property tax system is broken. Measures 5 and 50 limit the ability of local residents to pay for the services that they want. And this bill, by eroding the tax base, would just make that issue a little bit further. What do cities do to compensate when they lose revenue? They have to go to fees, and those are often fees that are regressive in nature, and they will hit lower income folks harder. And so we do have to oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. The next speaker is Jeff Stone. And if there's time after that, I will go to Kevin Mannix.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. Can you hear me all right?
Jeff, let me interrupt for a moment. I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am. Representative Levy, I didn't see your hand up in time. Did you have a question for the last speaker?
She's on mute, Madam Chair.
Representative Levy, do you have your hand up still?
Sorry, I'm talking away. I apologize. So I know enough about this because it's part of our business, and it's not done in a factory. It's actually done in a pasture and some other stuff. So I just want to clarify that and make sure that you understand that this type of machinery, although I'm opposed to this bill, this type of machinery is not done in a factory. That was really all I had to say.
And Rep. Nathanson, if I may.
Mr. Garst, let's not get into a back and forth.
Okay.
I would invite you, however, to send us some written response to the testimony from today and to any questions, because I had already called on Mr. Stone. Jeff Stone, you're next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Stone, and I'll be mercifully brief. So I am the executive director of the Oregon Association of Nurseries, your largest sector of ag. At your direction, Madam Chair, and with Representative Marsh, we have been working on trying to find common ground and a resolution about the farm property tax issue. I would submit with Representative Levy's permission that these pieces of equipment aren't factories. I mean, the one thing that's disappointing in this bill is that this doesn't fit neatly with the kind of work that's we've been trying to do to date. Not to say that the hay folks aren't important, but there's not hop dryers in this. There's a variety of other types of equipment that could fit in a bill such as this, but are not. And so we're very disappointed in that the proponents did not reach out to a group that's been well-established, Madam Chair, to try to get at resolution of this issue. I want to be on the record that the ag community wants to try to find a solution to this. I was part of the 2007 bill with the Farm Bureau that really dealt with estate tax and how farm equipment is to be treated. And I think Representative Marsh and your work need to continue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. And we have just a couple minutes left before I had indicated I want to adjourn. Mr. Mannix, you're next.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in Salem. I'm also a former member of the House and a former member of the Senate. I appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly about this bill. Let's be clear about one thing. We did participate. We've continued to participate in discussions about agricultural equipment exemptions, et cetera, et cetera. Here we're talking about a particular piece of equipment that developed as a result of social policy change, good social policy change, to protect the environment. It used to be that 250,000 acres of Oregon land were burned after the grass seed was removed, and it were burned to get rid of the hay. And instead, we told our farmers to stop the burning, clear the air, and yes, they did. And what did they do with the hay now that they've stopped the burning? They found a market for it, mostly overseas. And in order to compete in that market, they had to develop a special kind of farm equipment and machinery to not just bale the hay in the field, but to compress it to get it into containers. And what that compression means is we're using less containers, which means less fossil fuel use, reduced carbon emissions, and yes, more efficiency in terms of the pricing, so our farmers can actually compete in the world market and sell this hay instead of leaving it in the fields. And our wildfires last year should remind us how dangerous it is to have brown grass sitting in a field after it's been cut if there's no market for it. I'm shortening up my remarks. I will present some written testimony to you. This bill passed the Senate in a similar fashion with a unanimous vote 4 years ago after lengthy discussion. And what we're down to is most farm equipment is already tax exempt. There are some specific issues that arise. And the issue that arose here is that some of our assessors are saying because the equipment was moved into a barn and it's bolted to the floor for safety reasons, that it's now real property that is subject to taxation as opposed to being in the field where it was considered not subject to taxation. There you go.
Thank you for the testimony. For Samantha Bayer and Jesse Bounds, I'm sorry that we did not have time to get to your testimony today. You are welcome to join us at our next meeting. Staff will be in touch with you. You are welcome to join us. I will reopen the public hearing if you would still like to testify. If you're not able to, or someone has already covered the point you wanted to make, then you don't have to testify if you don't want to, or you can submit a letter to us. Write a note, a letter, and it will become part of the record. It's your choice how you would like to proceed. We will make time for you at the next meeting if you would still like to testify. Committee members, do you have any questions or comments before I close today's public hearing on 3317? I'm carrying over House Bill 3317 to our next meeting. Mr. Allenack, any comments or observations before we end the meeting today?
No, Madam Chair. I think you covered your agenda.
Okay. Thank you all for your patience, and I'll see you at the next meeting. We're adjourned.